my work. Let me begin by briefly illuminating the title of my talk. The Stanner model of particle physics is an extremely precise theory, and it has proven its predictive power during the last decades. We have some well-established cornerstones of our theoretical frameworks that are very well confirmed by experiment. However, we also have several experimental data that cannot be explained so far. Most of them are known as some kind of a problem, the cosmological constant problem, the horizon problem. And of course, we would like to know how to solve them. So the experimentalists have surely been busy during the last decades. Meanwhile, in the theory department, people have not been lazy. In the last 20 years or so, very much progress has been made towards our understanding of the question how to quantize gravity. And of course, it would be wishful to connect these theories to experiment, but so far no direct prediction can be made from a top-down approach. It is, however, possible to use effective extensions that only include some specific features of these theories that might allow us to connect not only a theory to experiment, but also one theory to the other when we focus on similarities between them both. So some time ago, I wrote a research proposal for the German Science Foundation, and I required a title, and I picked the title Phenomenological Quantum Gravity. I later found in a review article by Thomas Thiemann that he named that non-orthodox approaches. I did not think non-orthodox approaches would have made a good title for a research proposal, but it points more clearly towards the fact that these approaches lie somewhat outside the two main laws. So one example of such an effective extension of the standard model are theories with extra dimensions that might have been born somewhat out of frustration in the string theory, and then allow us to investigate the question of extra dimensions. I will say a bit about that. Then I will talk in more detail about the question of a minimal length and modifications of special relativity, and also a bit about black hole physics, which is kind of my favorite approach. And then there are, as always, several topics that I will not talk about. So to begin with the models with extra dimensions, I used to say these are recently proposed, so that's a sure sign I'm getting old. One of the most common approaches is the not so recently proposed model by Akani, Hamid, Demopoulos, and Twali, which is also the most simplest one. Space-time is just equipped with the extra space-like dimensions, each of them compactified on a circle with the same radius. And this radius is much larger than the inverse new higher dimensional Planck scale. So this new scale should be of order several TeV, if the radius should be not larger than, say, 1 over 10 millimeters or so. The nice feature of this model is that it solves the hierarchy problem, or at least reformulates it in a geometrical language, because gravity can propagate into all extra dimensions and thereby gets diluted and is much weaker than the other interactions of the standard model. Another model is the model by Randall and Sundrum, which in which case the extra dimensions are not flat but are curved and have that so-called warp factor. This is a nice playground for the ABS-CFG correspondence. And another very interesting thing about that is that in a type 2 model, the X that I mentioned does not have to be finite. Maybe the most straightforward thing one can do are models with universal extra dimensions. One of the nice features about this model is that one has an accelerated running of the coupling constants. They do no longer run logarithmically, but receive power law corrections, and so they can meet at a much lower scale. Well, one can combine this model with the first one by putting these universal extra dimensions into a spacecraft with large extra dimension as kind of fat grain or so. So that there would be a more general case. And then I would also like to add this big chromium scenario, which is not exactly extra dimensional model on its own, but it is kind of a quick fix for several problems like the proton decay or flavor changing decays or so that well, one cannot observe and that need to be suppressed by a high scale. And in this model, the new fundamental scale might be much lower. So in this case, one can use the split fermion scenario in which one pulls away wave functions of, say, different flavors. And then the coupling between them is given by the overlap of the wave functions, which can be exponentially suppressed. So just to briefly mention some of the observables of extra dimensions, I will not give you any constraints because these models have really grown up during the last some years. And so the most current constraints on them you can find in the particle data booklet. So you can have excitations of all particles that are allowed to propagate into the bulk that might be observable. In the ABD model, black hole production becomes possible at much lower energies because gravity is much stronger at short distances than in the usual framework. So this is an example of such a process where you usually would have made a jet that hadronizes into several particles. It would now make a black hole, which then evaporates and produces a thermal spectrum of all particles that you can have. Then there is the real graviton production in a diagram, something like that. So the double wavy line is supposed to be a graviton. One can compute such diagrams on tree level by using a perturbative approach. However, that does not change the fact that gravity is still non-renormalizable. So I do not feel so exactly comfortable with it. One can do it, but I'm not going to talk about that. Another thing is that the exchange of virtual particles that might be the graviton or KK excitations will cause modifications to cross-section in the standard model. Now, the problem if you compute something like that is that in higher dimensions, the summation or with the small step size integration over this power will diverge. And in this case, one has to introduce some kind of a cutoff that is usually assumed to be somewhere close by the Planck scale or the new fundamental scale. And that was the reason how I came to models with a minimal length scale. If you're looking at the model with large extra dimensions and you have a lowered Planck scale, then that means that you have also raised the Planck length. And if effects coming from lowering of the Planck mass are observable, then one should also expect effects coming from the existence of a minimal length to become observable in the same range. The existence of a minimal length scale is a very general prediction that one can make for all theories that should include a quantum description of gravity. The reason is that if a particle comes to energies close by Planck mass, that it will cause fluctuations of space-time that can no longer be neglected, and that will cause an additional uncertainty and thereby set a bound to how good we can resolve structures. So in the worst case scenario, this might mean if this scale lies within the reach of colliders, that there is no use to build any larger colliders because the closer we look, we do not see any more. So people who work on collider physics should be kind of concerned about that. It can be found from various approaches: string theory, loop gravity, non-commutative geometries. Seems that should be NCG. Yes, and the reason why this should occur in a very general way is that this minimal length scale acts as an ultraviolet cutoff. So this is why we need it. So let me be very clear, what I aim to do at this point is not to derive a minimal length scale from some of these approaches, but instead I assume that there is such a minimal length scale, and I ask how we can include that into the standard model. How can we modify our description of quantum mechanics, of quantum field theory, in such a way that it will have the features of a minimal length? So you can start by considering how or why collider work. If we want to resolve a small structure like in our spacetime, then we need to go to very high energies, because high energies mean small wavelength, and the wavelength should be smaller than the average size of the thing that we want to look at. Now, if you assume that the wavelength has a lower bound, then such a resolution is not possible anymore. And this is the onset of this model I'm going to tell you about. You assume that the relation between the wave vector k and the momentum is no longer linear, but it is a function in such a way that the wavelength has a lower bound, or the wave vector and its component have an upper bound. So this is an example of such a function. It has fulfilled certain properties. One property apparently is that in the low energy limit, it should reproduce the standard linear behavior. It should asymptotically reach the inverse of the minimal length. And it should be a monotonic function because it should be invertible. So you can plug this into quantum mechanics, and then you find that the commutation relation between the momentum and the position operator is modified. From this you can derive a version of the uncertainty principle, and you find that it will be modified to a generalized uncertainty principle. In a first order expansion, it will look something like that. I should point out that this coefficient B1, which is actually proportional to A1, might be zero, so the leading contribution might have a higher power. This also results in a modification of the measure in momentum space, basically by the Jacobian of the functional relation. If you want to look at the behavior at high energies, it is not so useful anymore to use a power law expansion, but you should use an expansion at high energies. One of the functions that are frequently used is the tangens of a vorticus, and in this case, this limiting behavior would look something like that. But very general, since this function has to become asymptotically constant, the derivative will drop to zero. So the phase space at very high energies is squeezed, and this is the basic reason why this thing works as a cutoff in the ultraviolet. Since the relation between momentum and wave vector is nonlinear, you also get a modified dispersion relation. Now you can proceed with this by quantizing in the standard way. You start with the energy-momentum relation and quantize it so that it looks very similar to what we usually have, with the exception that this momentum is now a function of k, which in the quantized version is expressed by partial derivative. So that will have higher order derivatives. You can do basically the same thing for the Dirac equation. Looks very similar again. It will be a higher order derivation. Then you can go to quantum field theories, starting with the commutation relation between annihilation and creation operators. Again, the basic contribution is from the Jacobian of the relation. The Lagrangian for the free fermion field is readily found, and you can couple it in the usual way, which in first order yields the common vertex. However, there are some higher order contributions that in the following I have not considered. The reason for this is that this model, of course, has its limitations. In particular, it cannot say anything about the structure of the interaction that we have. And in principle, you might add some higher order terms that might come from wherever. So I did not find it so useful to say anything about the higher order terms, because this is not something that the model can sensibly say something about. Yes, if you consider the notion of a minimal length, you note that there's a problem. If you take a minimal length scale and you boost it to high energies, then it will get contracted, and then what? It will be smaller than minimal, so that shouldn't happen. So whenever you have something like a minimal length scale and you want to make sense of that, that requires a modification of special relativity. And in the first paper, I noted that and just wrote, well, there's the problem with the Lorentz invariance, one has to think about it. And some years later, I found time to think about it, so there is kind of a gap of 2 years between that. And actually, if one wants to build a model with this, one needs both. So this is important for self-consistence of such a model. Just to tell you what notation I have used here, I have split it up, the wave vector and momentum, into the time-like space-like part, so I'm only considering one spatial dimension here. And for a better clarity, I have labeled that function with f. So the momentum transforms under the usual Lorentz transformation, but the wave vector will have modified transformation law that will be nonlinear.
Can I ask you just a general question?
Yes.
Normally in quantum mechanics, we think of momentum being the wave vector, right? I mean, we think of it as the same thing. You've broken the connection between
yes.
them. So which things are some of the things we think of normally in jeopardy, like what happens to conservation of momentum in this theory, for example? Because it's not directly associated with the translation invariance of the doesn't seem to be directly associated.
Yes, well, if you're talking about a single particle, then both of them are conserved. The reason is that the wave vector k is a function of p, and if the one commutes with the Hamiltonian, then both will.
Yeah.
So for more particles, the thing is not so clear. I actually think it's a not completely resolved issue. I will come to that later.
Okay, and that's related to the other question I had, which was why you chose e squared minus p squared equals m squared as your equation of motion. Is that sort of non-arbitrary? I mean, it looks...
this one?
It looks natural, but we could easily well say omega squared minus k squared equals m squared. That would be a different equation, so... I'm just wondering what's the rationale for that particular choice.
Yeah, I start with this. Thing is the physical quantity that is conserved. So the other one is kind of an effective description.
So you assume that the ultimate theory P will be the conserved quantity.
Yes.
So just realistically, you could actually have both. You could still preserve E equals H bar omega and vice versa, and just change the time coordinate equation. So there's actually three options at least.
Three options?
So I could either have modified the special relations for EP, for omega k, for both things, and preserve the usual.
Well, in that framework, I've always assumed that the momentum is the standard thing that we have. So it's what we usually connect with the particle. And the wave vector is something that has a modified behavior, which is supposed to describe additional features, like you would have if the thing were not a point particle, but a string. Yes, there are different options. It's not unique. This is the model that I have used. Yes, you're right. There are several unsolved issues.
So basically, the reason that the fact that P is not equal to K appears really in the definition of what you mean by a wave, because it's a wave number, and that's really appearing in that equation in the middle there, for example. In other words, because it hasn't. Others could do away with K completely and just say, well, P is the thing, it hasn't been deformed. At some point, you've got to say, well, actually, K is a wave number, and here is an equation which justifies that. Now, you're saying K is a wave number, but what is justifying that statement?
So the way I have used it is just the terminology, because I didn't want to be there any confusion that these are two quantities, two different quantities. Now, you mean if I actually look at the wave, what allows me to say that this is...
K and not P, for example, is actually the wave number.
If you consider a free particle, then both the descriptions are actually quite similar. So, because the whole spectrum is continuous, so there is not so much of a difference. In the case where you actually want to look at a specific problem, then you will find that you can only construct a maximally localized states that you then have to interpret.
Okay. I mean, what basically, if you're setting things up for the way you want things to work, what I don't understand is where you've actually checked that somehow that the waves in the theory actually have the wave number k as you supposed.
Okay. Yeah, well, you can only do that if you actually solve some equation. So up to now...
You do have to claim for an equation, so you can find the waves for that.
Because they would just work with P, and then the waves would be the usual waves.
Yeah.
So that's wrong, apparently. Apparently, they're not going to give the right waves. The right waves are for me to the IK. Someone has to explain.
Okay, the thing is that the way I have used the term wave vector or wavelength is a terminology.
But you have to justify it.
Well, as far as I don't apply any constraints to it, it doesn't mean anything.
Okay,
it becomes important. For example, if you consider a system of boundary conditions, then the question is which of the both have to fulfill this boundary condition.
For example, if you did a diffraction experiment, maybe you could see the meaning of the label.
Right. So you will always have to focus on experiment that actually can say something about the momentum or the wave. That can actually do both. It's not sufficient to look at one.
So just to go back again to the Klein-Gödel equation you wrote. So you do have plane waves as solutions for that, and then you can define wavelength as just the periodicity of these things in space.
Yes.
So it is actually a wavelength.
But that would be the usual equation.
But it's actually it's the second equation that counts.
Yeah, I'm confused also because I thought in the previous slide, if you go back, somewhere there, you were implying that, from the commutation link between P and X, basically you're implying that K is D by DX. K is an eigenvalue of D by DX, and therefore is the wave. If you would.
I would go for. If you put the Klein-Gödel equation, which is one thing, which is the other one, in the box. So that thing is solution, right?
Yes.
Which are plane waves. Yes? So plane waves, immediately you identify the factor of the x and the factor of the t as the Taylor angle. And they're physically determined immediately. And you have dispersion relations which are formed. So they're basically the right-hand side of the top, not the left-hand side. So I do think you have a meaningful, physically meaningful wavelength of frequency.
The question of what equation you're solving, that paper is very innocent, but if p is raised to x by the modified commutation relation, then that equation is more complicated than it looks on the surface. That's your computation relation is p with x giving you d by dp by dp minus k. No, but that's how you solve that equation. That's an operator equation.
No, I think that's not the equation in the bottom is it's just waiting for a wave equation. It's waiting to hang out at the bottom.
Maybe it would become clearer if I show you actually the way the computations work out then. Okay, so I was about to explain how that necessarily includes a modification of the Lorentz transformation. So the way to come from the generalized uncertainty principle to the Lacan special relativity is by observing that you will know how the one quantity transforms if you know the transformation behavior of the other quantity and the transformation of the one to the other. So if you want to know the transformation of the wave vector k, you transform it into momentum, boost that one, and then transform it back. The other way around also works by observing that in the low energy limit, we know how the function looks like, because in this region, it's just the identity. So, and then the modified dispersion, this is just a rewriting of what I had earlier with the function. So this is a very useful connection and can actually be used to translate answers with a generalized uncertainty into some specific version of the quantum special relativity or the other way around. And one can, in principle, use that to build a self-consistent quantum field theory with the minimal length. That would be something very interesting to do. There are some unresolved issues. One is the multi-particle kinematics, because the transformation between the wave vector and the momentum is no longer linear. So there is an issue about what quantity is the conserved one. That might not be a unique definition. There is still discussion going on about that. Another thing is how you come from one particle to bound states of several particles, because if you look at some macroscopic object, it's apparently very easy to come to masses above Planck scale. And one has to explain why this approach only describes the elementary particles and how that effect vanishes if you go to larger systems. Okay, some consequences of a minimal length scale. The first thing that comes into mind if one has such a modified version of quantum mechanics is to look at the Schrödinger equation and say compute the energy levels on a hydrogen atom or something. You can do that, but it turns out that the modification for, say, the energy gap between the S1, S2 level or something is far off every experimental detection. So the same thing turns out for corrections to the general magnetic moment of the muon, which already receives a correction at the quantum mechanical limit. So much more interesting to look at are processes at high energies. So this is an example for a ratio of cross sections computed in the modified theory over the standard prediction. And a very general outcome is that one has a stagnation of the energy dependence of such cross sections. So this is a tree level process. For E plus E minus makes a fermion pair, and there are some data points. So you see, maybe not that clearly, but the constraints of on that minimal length scale or its inverse are kind of in the region where one has the constraints coming from large extra dimensions. So it's not so bad. So the reason.
Sorry, just I may have missed something. If I recall, you left the length scale arbitrary.
Yes. So that
means you can actually have a bound, maybe meaningless bound. You can have a bound on that length scale.
Yeah. So from these things, there you can derive bounds from that, but they are so weak. Then say it's like an inverse GEV or something that we know already. You would have seen that. So the reason why this stagnation of the energy dependence occurs is that it takes you higher energy to come to the same wavelength that you have had before. So you need more energy to come to the same resolution, and that gives you that stagnation. Okay, then also the black hole productions that people have looked at in scenarios with large extra dimension becomes modified for the same reason. It now takes a larger energy to get the particles close enough together so they can form black hole. So this is an example. There was a numerical calculation where you see the total cross-section for black hole production NTP collision at LHC in comparison to the version with the generalized uncertainty principle. So that's just to show you that the framework in practice works pretty good. Then there are several other very exciting things one can look at. For example, it has been proposed that such modified version of special relativity might say something about the cosmic ray puzzle. Though I'm afraid cosmic rays will not be so really conclusive about that. Then you can also have a varying speed of light, though that must not necessarily be the case. And that could be observable because it results in an energy dependence of the time of a flight of photons from gamma ray bursts, and that might be observable in the coming years. To come back to why I originally looked at that, the way such a minimal length works as a regulator, very general, if you look at such a self-energy contribution in a standard four-dimensional scenario, then you can roughly estimate this integral by posing a cutoff in the infrared and the ultraviolet, and you find that it runs logarithmically. If you go to higher dimensions, you can do the same thing. Actually, people have done that. And you find that it runs with the power law. That was what I referred to on one of the first slides, that in higher dimensions you find that the coupling constants run with the power law. So if you go to the modified theory, then here occurs this Jacobian factor, and this is what makes such a contribution finite. This is especially important if you have higher dimensional theories, because then in general the coupling constants will be dimension full, and that is not renormalizable. I mean, you can still renormalize it, but the result will depend explicitly on the cutoff, and then you have the question how you interpret that cutoff. So the minimal length kind of solves this issue. Because you have a very natural interpretation of the cutoff. So as an example, if you compute a thing like that, you look at the propagator and you know that it will receive additional contribution. If you look closer, the particles can do funny things. The standard approach is to expand it in a series of one particle irreducible contributions. So these are just these blocks. And this can be formally summarized to give you a formula how you can compute the full contribution in terms of one loop contribution. The amazing thing is, if you do that within the framework, you can actually compute that analytically. And there's a very straightforward interpretation of the thing, that is that because you have a finite resolution of your space-time, the higher order contributions become increasingly unimportant. So there is no way of looking closer and closer.
Just a question. I thought you had a minimum length, but not a maximum energy.
Right, the thing is still divergent in the infrared, so, but that you treat in a standard way.
No, I mean, I thought the cutoff was actually in frequency space, not in energy space.
Yes, this is, so you start in the K space where you have a cutoff, and then you can transform that into the other space, and this is where the Jacobian comes from. So it's actually completely equivalent both. It's just that it turns out in this description it's easier to treat the integrals because the upper bound is infinity. So one has this very nice interpretation, and this is just an example how that looks like. So you see that there is the calculation with cutoff, with a hard cutoff, and then the thing with the minimal length. So it looks kind of similar. I should also add that, of course, this functional relation between wave vector and momentum is not known. So there are some ambiguities if you do so. You can, of course, parameterize these in unknown coefficients. But the interesting thing is that because the asymptotical behavior is always the same, this curve will not differ so much from another, especially the high energy limit will always look the same. So what should be done is, of course, to constrain such a model from top down. That means what kind of functions would you expect if you try to derive them from, say, string theory, loop gravity, and so on. There has been lots of work done, but at least to me it's not so completely clear if one can actually rule out certain types of functions. And then a point that I find very interesting is the relation to non-commutative position space or curved momentum space, because I see how that arises in such a framework, though it's not so clear to me how that, how the meaning is of that. Okay, so to come to the last point, my favorite topic, the black holes. Black holes.
Before you come to that, maybe you can comment. There was some work by Daniel Sudarsky, and I forget his co-workers, Louis Lutia, who claimed that if you had a cutoff of momentum on wavelength, short distance cutoff, I'm not sure that they distinguish wavelength and momentum, but something like a momentum cutoff or a wavelength cutoff, you've got very bad violations of Lorentz invariance, sort of not suppressed by powers of inverse five-pack or anything. I don't remember the details. Are you familiar with that? Do you know the relationship of that work to this?
But I have a violation of the Lorentz invariance. I mean, that's what I mean.
Yeah, but not just something that we would see sometime in the future, but something that we would be seeing right now. It's well above experimental bounds.
No, I don't think that would occur in that approach. I'm pretty sure I don't know.
I think it was valid in one very concrete model.
You look at the nine violation when you have an ether, right, the vector field which is there, and then they show that you have an ion on the correct operator, not the five operator, then it would be feedback in the other zero. But there's a very different
type of secret.
But it's
one of the different.
It's a secret correlation.
Which word?
That's all. Okay, so the great thing about black holes is that they combine completely different fields of physics. That is what I think makes them so interesting, especially in the context of large extra dimensions. Black holes could become observable at the LHC. This has led to a very high amount of papers on the subject, in which the horizon formation in the two particle collision has been examined and the evaporation or the decay of such an object. The interesting thing about this is that one actually could have done that earlier, but it kind of needed the possibility to observe this thing that people have looked at it. And I think especially the process of horizon formation is a very interesting thing to look at. Such objects, if they could be created, would be a very clear signature at the LHC. That's the point I've worked on for quite a while, and about this line I could talk for 1 hour or so, so I will not do that. I would just like to mention that there are very precise numerical tools available to simulate such events and, say, PP collisions and so on. So on the numerical side for event generators, there has been an enormous amount of progress. Interesting is also the issue of black holes, which has not been so much investigated as I think it should have been. So in principle, if you have a high energy collision, you can, even if a black hole is not really formed as an end state, you could have a virtual black hole in an intermediate state, and such an object could violate some conservation laws, say, flavor or something. So it could kind of induce contributions to flavor change in the case. Well, the question, what happens to the color charge if some partons are colliding, is, as far as I know, an unresolved issue that maybe I would like to work on at some point if I find the time, because I have the impression that in a standard way it's usually assumed that the colliding objects are color neutral. But what then happens to that color field? So it seems to me that should have an influence on the horizon formation. Well, it is clear that the topics I mentioned in the beginning are cross-related in very many ways. Maybe one of the most interesting cross-relations is that between black holes and the minimal length. I will not say very much about that because there will be a talk on Thursday, which will say more about that. A very simple argument is that if you squeeze more energy into a smaller region of space-time, then at some point you will make a black hole, but the radius of a black hole will increase with the energy, and that makes an additional contribution to the position uncertainty. So that's a very sloppy argument, but it works quite nicely, and it shows you that there is some connection between the black hole and the minimal length scale. So there are a vast number of interesting things that one can look at. One that I find very interesting is that the minimal length naturally simulates something like a non-local interaction, because if you have two particles away by a minimal length, they should know there's another particle. The question is, does that reduce the degrees of freedom of some system, and there are some other implications that I'm working on right now, or I'm supposed to work on. So to come back to what I said in the beginning, phenomenological quantum gravity is the attempt to connect pieces of the puzzle by focusing on specific questions, and thereby trying to relate theory to experiment, or one theory to the other. So I'm good in time. Then I have some time for some personal remarks. If you look back in the history of science some centuries, then you will find that scientists have very often worked on completely different fields. think about names like Euler, Laplace, or Helmholtz. These people have worked not only on physics, but also on chemistry or medicine. Well, since that time, very much has changed, and the tree of sciences has split into very many branches, which have split into even finer branches. And if you want to work on a very on the front of research, you necessarily have to specialize into a very specific topic. I've always tried to avoid to end up on a single leaf somewhere up here, not even knowing what the guy next door is working on. But it's not only a question of interest, it's also a question of what is doable if you consider the reality constraint. So besides the things that I have just talked about, I also have these large questions that I avoid thinking about for too long. And since the Perimeter Institute seems to be the place for the big questions, I thought I'd bring them with me. One question that I think one should examine very carefully is the question, what is quantization? The reason is that I think we have not understood why the naive attempts to quantize gravity fail, because we do not know what quantization really is. Now, you might think, what kind of a question is that? Does that make sense at all? Actually, more than 99% of what physicists I've always asked tell me that they do not understand quantization, that they do not like that, but that they think that we have to accept that. So the one exception was an experimentalist who just said, I do not believe in quantum mechanics. Now, let me give you an example. If I give a lecture about general relativity, and a student comes and asks me, what is gravity? I tell him, gravity is the curvature of space-time in which we move on a geodesic, and thereby it looks as if we fall down on Earth, something like that. If that student would have asked the same question, say, in 1680 or something, someone would probably have told him, what kind of a question is that? We have the law, let's just use it and describe it. So maybe in some centuries, people will know more about that. I believe there has been a very interesting work by Lee and Puccini, who tried to get close to this by using stochastical differential equations. So maybe that's the right way. Then there's also the question, what is matter? Is our universe made up of space, and then there is matter in the space, or will both actually turn out to be the same? That also relates to the question how maybe loop gravity is connected to string theory, or maybe not. I believe he has actually solved both of the questions. And then there's also the question why our space-time of 3+1 dimensional, that does seem to you a question on a completely different level, but I believe it to be very interesting for processes in the early universe, like the question for the matter-antimatter symmetry and the inflation.
I thought space-time was four-dimensional, but maybe I was wrong.
Yeah, well, 3+1. I hope that's still 4. Okay.
Yeah, that's your list of questions.
Huh?
Is 3+1 = 4? That's another question.
Yeah, that's another question. But I think I can solve that if I think really carefully. So, yes, I would like to leave it at that point, and this is your homework. And thank you for your attention.
Still time for questions? Or is anybody on the homework?
What's the guy doing there with the shoes?
Oh, he's looking for inspiration, I think. I'm one of the truth.
So you talked about a minimal lay on some ultraviolet cutoff, and you also talked about some associated non-locality. Now, this seems to be a very general kind of setup that occurs in more than one situation. So I know best the case of causal sets, where one is trying to define some sort of generalization or analog of, say, the Down-Gordon operator, so that you could write down something like the Klein-Gordon equation on a causal set. The causal set has a minimal, built in a minimal length scale of cutoff. But you seem to find in this construction that you need to introduce an intermediate length scale, which is larger than the fundamental length scale, and which some sort of non-locality associated with the deep structure survives. So what I'm saying is that it seems that you get two length scales, one associated with ultraviolet cutoff, and one associated with the non-locality, or the non-locality. You also mentioned non-commutative geometry, possible connections. Something strictly analogous, although it's not clear-wise, the same phenomenon, but something very analogous happens there. So if you talk about what people call the fuzzy sphere, which is a sphere with non-commutative coordinates, in some sense, there's some sort of ultraviolet cutoff, which is the smallest length you could possibly resolve on the sphere. And then there's what you might call a non-locality scale associated with the non-commutativity of the coordinates, the configuration space coordinates. And that non-locality scale is significantly larger than the ultraviolet cutoff scale. It's sort of the geometric mean between the radius of the sphere and the ultraviolet cutoff. So my question is, have you seen anything similar in your setup? In other words, what's the connection between the non-commutativity scale, or the non-locality scale, I think you called it, and the ultraviolet cutoff? Naively, one might think them to be the same, but in those two examples that I've given you, it seems that they're in fact quite different.
Yes, I thank you very much for bringing these examples into my attention. Unfortunately, I haven't yet worked so much on that. I agree with you that it's not a priori clear whether these two scales should be the same. Maybe one can find out how the two are related to each other.
Why do you think there's a connection between minimal length and locality? It's not, or non-locality, rather, it's not clear to me, because if you have lattice theories, for example, I mean, they obviously have a minimal length, but still, I mean, if you have, say, one particle here, you would call, I mean, if they have nearest neighbor interaction, you would presumably call this a local model. So I don't see quite the connection. I mean, if you have a minimal length, it just means you sort of presumably modify your notion of what locality means. I mean, then I would say reasonably locality means if it's sort of close by in terms of minimal length rather than being somewhere else.
Yes, that's what I meant. You have a different notion of what locality means, or you have a modified locality if you compare it to the standard one.
I think the point is that non-locality, she was thinking of non-locality as with respect to thinking of the lattice inside ordinary Rn.
So you kind of have points between the points on the lattice.
I think one point, which is that the two things which are usually mixed up in the literature is compactness of mental space and non-commutativity of mental space, or non-obedience of mental group. And these are very different things. So even a torus, something that Laurent and I explored in our recent paper, but even for a torus is a good example of a circle. So their momentum is bounded, it's a circle, it's to discrete space, so there's non-locality like there, but not non-commutativity of mental space.
I haven't been talking about non-commutativity in...
Well, that corresponds to non-commutative geometry. So the non-commutativity scale in visual space corresponds to non-abelianness in the space. And the point is that is an independent quantity from the compactness of momentum space, which is the UV bounded. And so an example would be a Kapitsa-Thackeray model, which is unbounded in momentum space, but has non-commutativity. At the other extreme, you've got the circle, which is bounded in momentum space, but it's commutative. So the two things are actually independent. It's partly an answer to Martin's question. There's no intrinsic reason for those two things to be the same.
And in fact, I think that links up to Raphael's question.
Yeah.
You can have non-commutivity without a minimum length, and therefore you can have a non-commutivity that is parameterized by some dimension for quantity and sets there for some sort of scale, but there's no length.
Right, in principle, they could turn into different, but I'm just saying there seem to be a lot of situations in which they're unexpectedly tied together. Often there's some relationship between an ultraviolet scale, an infrared scale, and a commutativity scale, or an intergalactic scale. So I was just wondering, the fuzzy sphere is the most simple example of that. It's a very simple relationship. So I was just wondering if something like this. It's just would be a further example of that. And I think there are good physical reasons. Well, okay, that's another story. But I mean, I think there are good reasons. There is a connection when you take Lorentzian
rates. Yeah. I want to ask a different question because your emphasis was on phenomenology, and so if I understood right, you started with the large extra dimension idea, in which and then. From that went to the minimal length, and in that case, the minimal length would be related to the five-dimensional quantum length, the six-dimensional quantum length.
That's what one would expect.
Yeah, which is much larger than we usually imagine the minimal length to be. So, so supposing that that's correct, what would be the first place that, in effect, supposing that the minimal length really is an inverse TED, an inverse 10 TED, something like that. What's the first place that it will turn up experimentally?
Well, the first place would probably be cosmic rays, but the question is how you could really say this is the effect, that it comes from this thing and from nothing else. So that might be the first place to look at, but it might not be the best. So I would put my bet on the LHC.
And what would be the signature?
Well, it would be a very general modification of all cross sections. I don't think you could get that with any other model.
I mean, the summation effect that you refer to.
Yes.
Well, I would think it's inverse square law is more likely for the loop.
It depends on how the scale is modified. She's supposing it's been modified right down to the TV scale.
Yes, please. So for that, yeah, my question is, I would think that inverse square law is a possibility.
You might have the inverse square law is... okay, that is something that I think the model cannot sensibly say anything about, because this description is kind of supposed to effectively describe the effects of the gravitation, by assuming that there is a modification in the sense that I had just talked about. So,
I suppose in a sense it's just anybody's guess. You don't know where it show up. I don't know what Lee had in mind.
Well, no, I think I asked the direct question. I got a direct answer, which is stagnation cross sections universally at the LHC, which would certainly be a surprise to people who are looking for supersymmetry.
They could save lots of money because they wouldn't have to build a larger collider, and that could all go into theory.
But if you want to formalize square the law for gravity, I suppose if you want to subtract the Planck here and make it bigger, then the Planck length, it depends on how many extra dimensions you have and what you do with them, at what point you want to ask the law would be affected.
Yeah, that in addition to that, yeah.
This was just going back to the very beginning of your talk. You mentioned four sample series, and I'd only ever heard of the first two, and I didn't really understand what the last two were.
Universal extra dimensions is just additional extra space-like dimensions that are as in the first model or compactified as at a radius usually assumed to be the same, but in this case the radius is about the inverse of the fundamental scale, so it's not much larger than that, and therefore all of the particles can propagate into them. So that would still be unobservable so far, because in that case the excitations of the particle, say a photon or so, would come in steps of, say, 2 TeV or something.
Isn't that just the original positive quantum theory, basically?
Knuther and Klein, I think, actually tried to do more. I mean, they tried to put the gauge principle into
it. Oh, yeah, but I mean, it's just a new name for the idea, the old idea where you no longer put a brain inside.
Well, maybe the new thing is that the scale would be some 10 TeV, so
yeah,
and not 10 to the 16.
And the fourth one? What was the fourth one?
The first one? The
no,
first one was.
Four.
Okay. Let me just. Okay, so that was the first one with the large extra dimensions. Well, the Randall Sonder model, these are the universal extra dimensions. Well,
there
was a fourth. Yeah, there was a fourth. That was
the fourth.
But it's not really a model with extra dimensions on its own, but it's kind of a submodel that you can use to fix the problems.
I close the session. So Sabine will lead or this week. We can ask further questions.